Okay, today is October 3rd, 2008. This is the second interview with Shar Tortorici. Did
Good
I do
enough.
It right that time?
Good enough.
All right, it's going to be a battle each time. I apologize. this interview, we're going to try to get into more about the academic, well, governance on campus from an academic staff perspective, let's put it that way.
Okay.
But I want to go back to the question I finished with last time, and that was you were involved as a guidance counselor, you were involved in the union. You came here and you said you looked for a union, couldn't find it. How did you find Joanne Elder and Masa? How did that?
I got a flyer that came onto my desk. And I started on Tuesday, and this flyer came on Tuesday saying that there was a meeting coming up on Thursday. And I'm looking at Madison Academic Staff Association. Well, maybe this is the local WEAC chapter. Mm-hmm. And so I went to, the director wasn't in the office, but I went to the assistant director and said, should I do this? Should I, you know, become a member of this? And he looked at it, kind of scoffed, and said, well, that's up to you, but if you go, make sure you don't raise your hand. But I must have raised my hand, because I've been with the group ever since. And when I got there, it was, maybe 20, 25 people. And my former advisor, Joanne Elder, was there, and she was clearly leading the group. And there were some other people that whose names I had heard when I was a graduate student or an undergrad. And so I thought, golly, I'm sitting in the same room with all these important people. Mm-hmm. And I had loved Joanne as an advisee, so I walked up and said, hi, remember me? And of course she did, and it's been a wonderful relationship ever since.
Now that was, I know we have it on the first tape, but chronology-wise, was that 1978?
Is that 77.
77.
MASA had started in 1975, when the effects of merger first started to hit the Madison campus. Merger created a category called academic staff. Prior to that, the faculty and what is now academic staff had been called the unclassified. There was the classified folks that were covered under collective bargaining. There were students, which had their own governance rights, and then there were the unclassified. And we were essentially glommed together both for pay, but also in terms of some of the governance. Not necessarily executive committees and departments, but certainly campus committees and things. This campus has always had a very rich tradition of shared governance. And there's many, many, many committees. There's lectures committees, there's admissions committees, there's grievance committees, there's all sorts of things. And academic staff types always served on those. Well, by 1975, people realized they were not being appointed to those committees. They just weren't. And it hit them. Well, my goodness, we're no longer considered legal faculty. So if anybody's bringing up a list of who's eligible for these committees, we're not on it anymore. And so the Madison Academic Staff Association was formed. Joanne was a very, very strong leader in that regard. She was married to a faculty member who kept her apprised of all these things, plus being in a department herself in sociology. She knew what faculty were hearing, and she knew what academic staff types were not hearing. So putting two and two together, she said, we have been disenfranchised. Unintentional, to be sure. Nobody said, ha-ha, let's cut them out. But all of a sudden, legally, we were not eligible to be involved in joint governance. And because of that, we were not getting the same kinds of information from the administration. We suddenly were just doing our jobs and hoping that our supervisors were telling us about campus life as well as what we were expected to do on the job. The other thing that was very apparent was almost all academic staff had the same title. There was the great glob of specialists. Everyone was called a specialist. And many, many, many people were academic staff that didn't make any sense being academic staff, because you had people doing part of faculty jobs. You had what are now our lecturers and faculty associates. You had people doing research. a lot of faculty specialize in research, and that's what they do. So those were kind of like, why aren't those faculty jobs? They are everywhere else. But then you also had people like the hat check girl at the Memorial Union. In the 70s, they still had a hat check girl, and she was academic staff. So people were going, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We have to make some sense out of it. So I can't tell you what happened from 75 to 77, except that there were a lot of very active specialists who wanted better titles because they felt they needed titles that more accurately reflected what they were doing. By the time I got there in 1977, some of that was dissipating as people were putting more of their energy into knowing that we had to change the legislation. If we were ever going to get anywhere, we had to change Chapter 36 of the state statutes and get academic staff recognized as a governance group. And that's what MASA really focused on for about a decade, because we finally got governance in 1985 and formed our own governance units in 86. But from 1977 until 85, there was a pretty much a dual effort. There was an effort to get the state statute changed, and there was also an effort to get collective bargaining and enabling legislation anyway entrenched on all the campuses. Some of the outstate campuses were more successful and have somewhat strong union presence. Not that they have enabling legislation, they cannot collectively bargain, but there are some pretty strong local union chapters at the other campuses, some of them. Milwaukee, for one, is a strong WEAC campus. Stevens Point is a strong WFT campus. Madison, it never took, even though we do have a WFT chapter here. It's not real large. And they did try to start a WEAC chapter, but it never took hold. And then we had an unaffiliated union, Wisconsin University Union, WOU, for a while, that is no longer in existence, but was very, very important in aligning itself with MASA to help pay for lobbyists to get us governance rights. So that union turned out to be a very important step in our governance journey, and yet it did not survive.
So changing Chapter 36, maybe just elaborate a little bit on that. What did Chapter 36 say basically prior to?
The part of Chapter 36, and I can't remember if it's 0904, I think it is, but addressed governance, and it said under the not purview, but there's a word under the chancellor, the Board of Regents, the chancellors. It then gave governance rights and identified faculty and students, and that was it. They shall have the ability to help govern the institution. So the classified are recognized somewhere in that chapter, saying they have collective bargaining rights, and it is their contract that governs what their rights and responsibilities are. We just weren't we weren't there. And so we wanted to just add and academic staff to that. You know, academic staff shall have the ability to organize themselves in whatever the academic staff at each campus shall have the ability to organize themselves in whichever way they so choose and work towards the governance of the institution. That those are not quite the words, but that's what we were going for. So very simple change. The scary thing was that if you open Chapter 36, because we are so tightly controlled by the legislature, once it's open, do they start saying, you know, why don't we change over here too? And why don't we? So there was always this sense, at least that's what we were told by the administration, that if you try to open Chapter 36, you may end up, one, getting thrown in with the classified and be under that type of an arrangement as opposed to governance, and you might not like what you see, and you know. So there was always that sort of fear. But we thought we could get a bill that would be very narrow, very specific, and open to a lot of debate and discussion, because one of the things we thought we could do easily was to educate the faculty and the administration, and the students were always supportive of academic staff governance, but we thought we could very easily educate them, and they'd say, yes, come join us, please. That was not the case. A lot of faculty were concerned because they are the supervisors of academic staff, and they said, you can't have a supervisory employee relationship when there's equal governance. You know, you don't supervise your colleagues. And we're going, oh golly gee. You know, it happens in other institutions that have collective bargaining. Yes, it does. It happens all the time. And the administration was concerned, particularly our administration here on the Madison campus, because we more than double the numbers of faculty. The other thing is, I think the administration realized that throughout the 60s and early 70s, a whole lot of people had been hired into the academic staff ranks simply to avoid the difficulty of hiring within the classified structure. So if now you have people that are doing the exact same job, some of them classified, some of them academic staff, and if suddenly you gave some of those governance rights, oh golly gee, did you open the floodgates? We're still dealing with that to this day, because there are positions that have been identified as more reasonably put in the classified service, but the incumbent was given the choice. And there are incumbents that are truly not that old. They're in their maybe late 40s, early 50s now, but that were whose positions, when they come open, will be classified, but they have chosen to stay within the academic staff ranks. So that was a very interesting time. But we did think we could get a clean, simple bill to pass. The unions, both WU and UFAS, partnered with MASA to pay to have a lobbyist. And we got a lobbyist out of Milwaukee, a former priest, Dismas Becker, who was one of the Milwaukee Seven. So a very feisty fellow who then got married and went into lobbying. And he was very well known in the legislature and could work both sides of the aisle, and gave us all kinds of very good advice. He was sort of a rogue and just wonderful to work with. And he kept saying, you know, it is ethical and it's right and good that you want a separate bill and you want it debated clearly and so everyone is all on board. But, you know, the easiest thing to do would be to just put it on the end of the budget bill right at the end when everybody's exhausted and just let it go through. And we said, we will never do that. We just won't do that. That's awful. Well, in 1985, the budget had not passed easily. It was going on and on and on and on and on. And one day we got a phone call from Senator Joe Czarnecki out of Milwaukee, who had been a UW-Milwaukee academic staff member, who said, I can get this into the budget bill and I can guarantee you it's going to go through. Everyone's exhausted. They just won't even notice it. And we said, we are shocked that you would offer it. Go ahead. And he did, and that's how we got governance. And not much of a whimper. There were some other issues that the university was really concerned about, UW system. No one spoke against it.
So you've alluded to this, but I'd like to get hopefully a little more detail. It does sound very, you know, what you're saying sounds very simple, but it took 8 years.
It took 8 years, yes. We tried and tried and tried.
So does that mean each time the legislature met, you had a proposed bill?
No, it took a while for us to figure out how to do that. It probably took 2 or 3 years of the first few years we didn't have DISMIS. It took us a while to figure out that we needed a lobbyist, because it took us a while to realize that the legislature had no idea what academic staff was. It made no sense to them. Those words together don't make any sense. And when you talk to the legislature and tell them what you do, when I would say, well, I'm a testing supervisor and I do this, that, and the other thing, they'd look at you and say, but my professors did that when I was in college. Or when the registrar would go down there, they'd say, you're not faculty? No. And so they had no idea what the difference between faculty and academic staff were. And then on occasion they'd say, but the gal at the front desk in my department is academic staff, and how is that different than a secretary? And so there was some real confusion. And if they're really classified, put them in the classified. If they're not, why aren't they faculty? I don't get this. And certainly librarians and advisors almost everywhere else are faculty. As are research people at a PhD level, they're all considered research professors. And at every place except a Research One institution where research is not primary and perhaps not even on the table, professors only teach. Well, that's what our lecturers do. You're not a professor. I don't get it. And, you know, when you talk to the legislators about their children's experience in college, they were just absolutely blown away, because they were realizing that an awful lot of their education was being handled by people that were called academic staff. There's still confusion today. A lot of legislators don't have a clue. And that makes us real nervous when people start to think about pulling the compensation package apart and making part of it faculty only and part of it academic staff only, because that we'd be right back at square one with, well, who are you people and what are you doing? I don't get it. So it did take us a while to realize that that was our first battle. And then a while to realize that we couldn't battle that alone. We were not successful. We needed a lobbyist. So that's what the lobbyist was doing, was telling people what we did and really building the case that this is a very unusual personnel system, because these folks really are faculty at many of them anyway, at other institutions. And that was a several-year battle. And then there were the battles of, we have a bill, but it was getting shot down because system was talking against it, or the Madison administration was talking against it. And so we would always say, then take it off the table, because we don't want to lose. We don't want to vote and lose. And because we'd never get it back. Ever. So that's why when it came in as pork barrel legislation, we said, okay. If we hadn't had that long experience of just beating our heads against the wall, they don't get it, and now we're paying for a lobbyist, and we don't have the money to pay for a lobbyist, but we are, and a plain, simple bill is probably going to get shot down. We jumped. And, I'm in retrospect, I'm really glad we did. I wish it could have been a different model. But it went through, and academic staff across the system have organized themselves as each campus saw fit. And some have really flown and grown and really helped their institutions, and others have been a little sleepy.
It sounds like an example that the idea of, gain a pass by putting it, in an omnibus type situation, sort of pragmatic politics. It seems like that probably was the only way it was going to get done.
Well, that's, yes. That's,
I mean, it might
at
be,
those
it's
times.
Probably easier to say in retrospect than it was at the time. But, or even at the time, did you, at that point, you and others just say, all right, this is the only way it's going to work?
Oh, yeah. When we got that phone call, it was probably Joanne who got the phone call, and she made a couple of other phone calls and said, what do you think? And to a person we said to it, just do it. We got to get this through or we'll lose because it's dragging on and on and on. And part of that was the assurance that academic staff would then be looked at and the personnel system kind of cleaned up. And so a second step in that was what was called the Hayes Hill Study, because those were the consultants. And they took a conglomeration of things and made it worse. And we're still under this very cumbersome titling system that makes no sense whatsoever. And you, it's got Band-Aid after Band-Aid on it, but it's the title system within the academic staff and the ranges, they are all tied to salary ranges. So you may say, how is that different than being classified? Well, there aren't huge differences in terms of salaries because we're in very, they're broad ranges, but they're very strict ranges. So every title is associated with a range. And then we have Category A, Category B, and Category C academic staff. Category A academic staff are professionals that are not quite as close to faculty jobs as others. So a lot of administrators, the advisors, the librarians, social workers, the nurses when we had the hospital. Those were Category A, and they have a strict minimum. Every range has a minimum and a maximum. Then there's the Category B folks, who are a little more like faculty because their job is specifically the same research that faculty are doing, but only research, no teaching and outreach. Or they're just teaching our lectures and faculty associates, no research required of them, no outreach. Or in some cases, the outreach folks, but most of those fall into Category A. Now, Category B has a minimum range. It's set at 80% of a professor in the same field, but no maximum. So now you've got folks in the same personnel system, same governance rights, but very different circumstances, because one is initially tied to 80% of a faculty salary as a minimum. You can certainly be brought in at higher than that, but then no maximum. So as you stay on campus longer and longer, you actually can be compensated for that. The Category A people, you know, hit their head on the ceiling, sometimes very fast. If they're really good and get promoted, they could hit a ceiling real fast. Then there's the Category C, which they're okay. They tend to be faculty who have been appointed into administrative positions. Those are the folks who serve at the pleasure of. And they have absolutely no job security, so, you know, they can make as much as they want because they could displeasure someone and get no notice whatsoever. So we don't really pay, we being people who look out for academic staff personnel issues, we don't pay a lot of attention to them. Many of them have faculty backups. If they don't have a faculty backup, if you're smart, you make sure you've got an academic staff backup if you're going to serve at the pleasure of. And that is why we're seeing such difficulty bringing people from the outside in when we're doing searches that are administrative searches, because all of the administrative positions are in the academic staff. And you may have seen how much trouble it was to get a vice chancellor of continuing studies. As they looked outside, they were looking at faculty being appointed. But because of some difficulty on this campus with some of the personnel issues you've seen in the press, we can no longer offer people from the outside a backup appointment. So why would you risk coming in, especially at a time when the administration is changing? You're serving at the pleasure of someone who then leaves. You could lose your job, and if you haven't got a faculty backup, you've got no place to go, and you have left your home campus. So not being able to give those backups in the Category C academic staff has created some real problems where we've had failed searches. Currently, the position at continuing studies, they finally found an internal candidate who would take it as an interim because he has a faculty backup. If you're here and already have a position, you can have the backup because you're tried and true, but you can't come in from the outside and get a backup appointment.
So before we get back to the past, that sounds like hands will be tied. Conceivably, there will be administrative positions that will never, not that there aren't bad candidates internally, but part of sort of growing a campus, I think, anyways, particularly coming from the outside, is having strong people come from the outside and be able to question what's going on.
If the administrative position is attractive to faculty and you expect faculty to apply, you'll be hamstrung with your outside candidates. Hopefully after the sting of some of the negative press goes away, we can get that changed. But for now, UW system capitulated to pressure from the legislature and the press because they didn't want to be giving these tenure-like appointments to someone who was untried in the state of Wisconsin. But yes, it's awful. We have had failed searches. Mm-hmm. And we will continue to.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. I mean, it just...
And when you tell people from other states what's going on, they look at you so quizzically because their campuses are not controlled, the personnel policies are not controlled by the legislature. You know, the legislature says, here's the money we're willing to give you, now go do with it as you will. And they don't micromanage, but ours does. So we have a very interesting...
And we'll continue to as long as it's set up the way it's set up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We mentioned Joanne a couple of times. And, you know, hopefully this project gets to a point where Joanne is interviewed. But I would like you as... First off, to explain from what you've seen about her why she was so good at what she did.
Well, first of all, she's feisty. She is one of the most remarkable people you'll ever meet. Please interview her. You will love her. She was the undergrad advisor in sociology because she had an advanced degree in sociology, as did her husband. And her husband is probably one of the best known experts in Southeast Asian studies. And they spent his research years doing his dissertation in a tent in India, and she had babies over there in a tent in India, and you know, so she's got this side to her that is very adventuresome and Peace Corps-esque. She's also Quaker, and she was also raised in a very nice upper middle class home. So it's a mixture of being raised to serve and feistiness, seeing the worst of the worst and the best of the best, and she's a fighter and she is out for justice. She's still very active in Quaker movements in the prisons. She is just looking after the underdog. And then she found herself an underdog, which I don't think she ever expected. And with support from her husband, Joe, she was able to concentrate on a lot of things. She waited until the kids were older before she returned to working. And so she had some time, but she was willing to make time, too. And she had the spirit, and she had the support from her spouse. I could see other situations where, in fact, I know other advisors who were faculty wives that were very quiet during this time because their husbands did not support either their time to be active or their interest in saying that the faculty were not the very best people to solely govern the institution. But Joanne had Joe saying, "Oh, sure, we need all the help we can get," and she was able to put together a band of people that just worked hard. You wanted to please her because you just knew she was putting her reputation on the line a lot. She truly was an advocate. She would go to the administration and say, "You are wrong." She would sit in on, you know, if someone got arbitrarily laid off or fired and they asked her to, she would sit with them, with the executive committee, and say, "You people are wrong. You're absolutely wrong. She's a very strong unionist. She has always been in United Faculty and Academic Staff, and would, I'm sure, support enabling legislation and then collective bargaining for faculty and staff. And she has that kind of zeal. And you just like her. She's able to hold her own. Plus, she did not have any hesitation taking on the chancellor or taking on any faculty. Sometimes the faculty could get mean and say some pretty harsh things about academic staff and how they could get along without us and, you know, who did we think we were. In fact, before I came, that had been said, and I know that some of the schools and colleges said, okay, I guess we'll have all the advising taken over by faculty. And they laid off their advisors, and within a year, the faculty were saying, bring them back, please, 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 please. We don't know what we're doing. And the kids were shrieking and saying, we're not getting any decent advice, and we're not graduating. And, you know, so the one experiment of we can do without academic staff kind of failed. And then when you think about what would happen if we didn't have admissions people or registrars or advisors or librarians or housing people, how would we run the institution? But sometimes faculty didn't think that clearly and would say, we don't need them. You know, it was just an aberration of free-flowing money in the 60s and early 70s, and so all these people got hired, but we really don't need them. We are the crux of the institution. And Joanne had a different idea and support at home and on campus because of the respect that both she and Joe as professionals had generated. And they were probably, I know I've talked to some faculty wife advisors who said, I was fearful for my job. If I was going to be outspoken, the department could have fired me. The department was in no way was going to fire Joanne. I mean, not only was she a fabulous advisor, they wouldn't want to ruffle Joe's feathers because he is, to this day, one of our most eminent faculty members. He's still teaching, still doing his research, still doing his outreach.
Who else besides Joanne and yourself, particularly in this period of, I mean, I know you weren't here the 75 through 77, but let's just say 75 through 85.
A real good friend who became a real good friend of Joanne's, her name is Karen Carlson. She had been a faculty member at UW-Stevens Point, and when she transferred into the same job here as a speech and language clinician and teaching speech pathology, she was academic staff. And she was very active by 77 when I got here. She and Joanne had already found each other and were saying, yikers, what's this all about? And I believe Karen had been active in governance up at Stevens Point, so she really was, you know, she had both sides of it, as did Joanne. Steve Safian, who was in the Dean of Students office, was a quieter but very supportive person. Steve Myra, not quiet. He was willing to march anywhere and talk to anybody. He was in financial aids, and I'm not exactly sure why he had such fire, but he did. And, they were both of them very eloquent speakers, so easy to send downtown and build the cause. Dick West, who is a librarian still on campus. Both the Steves have retired, as have Karen and Joanne. But Dick West, very quiet, very solid, did not like doing anything publicly, but would do anything behind the scenes. So you could always count on Dick to get flyers out, to get newsletters out, to get meetings put together. And again, I'm not sure why he was so very active, but he was. And then there were some folks that were no longer here. Alastair McCormick was a scientist who was quite concerned that he wasn't a research scientist. I mean, a research professor. He was academic staff, and he was a very eloquent and elegant man that helped us build the cause. It's like, he was like a Jamie Thompson, you know, because people say, you're academic staff, why aren't you faculty? You know, and when you get those folks, they're wonderful if they're on on your side. And then there were some quieter people in the beginning, like Ann Wallace and Hank Loeffler, that became very strong advocates for academic staff. But in the first few years, were a little quiet because they were establishing themselves on campus and stuff. But that first group through Dick West and Alistair and Ross Reinhart, and don't ask me who he is, but I know that he had been fired. And by 1977, I never met the man. By 1977, people, he was kind of a legend. Don't let that happen to you, because it was arbitrary and capricious, and, you know, and we had no rights, and what about job security? The whole job security thing bothered academic staff too. It wasn't just governance. We needed to look at job security. But with the governance language, it said can organize themselves in whatever way and write their own policies and procedures, essentially. So we were looking at governance to give us the ability to control job security as much as we possibly could, which got us indefinite appointments, which got us rolling horizon appointments, which got us multiple term, fixed term appointments.
So, not that any day or any movement is typical, but what were some of the typical or day-to-day things that you would do to try to get this vision of governance into a reality?
Well, the first thing we did when it was clear that we had been disenfranchised from committees was to say, but are people still serving on committees ad hoc? Because you can't have an admissions committee without the director of admissions there. You know, so we started thinking, So one of the first things we did was put together a little committee to look at committees. And we surveyed every committee and looked at who was on the rosters. And I, in fact, was on several governance committees ad hoc, because I was on the university high school liaison committee, because I'd just been just in the high schools and I knew a lot of folks, and I made sense, but I was not officially appointed, but I was there to help with that endeavor. And what other, I was on something about testing, I can't remember. But anyway, we looked at one point, 120 academic staff members that were, in fact, involved in governance, not being recognized for it, and being there sort of ad hoc, but, and this was our point, helping the endeavor, not hurting it. So we could go to the administration and say, now, these folks who you know, who you love, who you want to have on your committees, are on your committees and doing what they're supposed to be doing, but they're not being recognized for it. Now, they're not rabble-rousing. They're not trying to undermine anything the university does. They just want to make this a better place for students, you know. And everyone said, well, golly, I guess you're right. And I think that really took a while for things to sink in, but that little subcommittee that looked at committees, I think, was very, very valuable, because nobody was rabble-rousing. Nobody was concerned. That has snowballed to the point where just a few years ago, a committee, well, it was the Committee on Retirement Issues, had always functioned with a faculty and an academic staff member kind of co-chairing. But in Faculty Policies and Procedures, Chapter 6, it says that it needs a faculty chair. So because we had always been acting as co-chairs, the faculty chair at the time, Jim Taylor, went to the Senate and said, we would like to change the wording of Chapter 6 that allows for co-chairs if the committee feels that that's appropriate. We thought it would be a unanimous, no debate item. Well, there was not only debate. How could you do this? How could you, you know, let go of your responsibility to chair? Several people brought up the fact that committees cannot find chairs necessarily within the faculty ranks where there are academic staff that would be willing to chair or co-chair, but that did not carry the day. What carried the day was a young man, and I have no idea who he was, but he stood up and he said, you cannot allow academic staff to chair or co-chair faculty committees that are covered under Chapter 6. Right now, the academic staff are the only people who do work on committees to begin with, and if you allow them to chair, we will be cut out of the whole governance process because we're really not doing a whole lot of work on some of these committees, and now they'll control the agenda and everything else. That carried the day, if you can believe it. I'm thinking, tongue-in-cheek, he's supporting academic staff, isn't that wonderful? No. No, they voted it down. They voted to maintain faculty as sole committee chairs. So needless to say, I have never co-chaired a Chapter 6 committee since, even though people say, well, you will do this, won't you? No, no, not as long as that language is there. Other committees, like the Committee on Women, say, we don't care what the language is, we're going to have co-chairs. Oh, that's great. If you do it informally, nothing will change. You know, you've got to make noise. Come on, academic staff on that committee. Say no and say the reason is we're not allowed to change that language. But they are polite on that committee.
So are all committees on campus Chapter 6?
Mm-mm.
I'm a little... Okay.
No. No, there are other committees that are not covered under faculty policies and procedures. The vast majority are, and those joint committees are all chaired by faculty. And there have been years when those committees, some of them have not met because they can't find a chair.
Has it ever been put to the faculty senate again?
No. No. You'd have to have a senator that had some zeal on that, and I would look to the Committee on Women since they're doing it anyway, but for some reason that committee has chosen not to follow up on it. Had they not been able to find a chair for the Committee on Retirement Issues, which is one that I still serve on even in retirement, because I'm serving through the Retirement Association, then I would have brought it back up and tried to find somebody, but we got a chair. and that person might be willing to do it, but committees are functioning. It hasn't been a hot topic, and I do fear that the more of us that retire that were there originally, mm-hmm. the less zeal there is because people don't understand what happens if you haven't got it. They've got it pretty good right now in terms of governance. Right now, we are still tied to the compensation package with faculty. That could change on a dime, and I worry that the academic staff is not well organized enough at this point to challenge anything like that. And I have to say, I hate going on record being against enabling legislation because I really support it. But if the language that has been put through the last couple of budget go-rounds is successful, it will just destroy what academic staff have worked so hard to do because it will disenfranchise them from the faculty completely.
So that's the thing you've mentioned a couple of times now, and that's the idea of the compensation package, which is
right.
Compensation package is healthcare, things of that
and nature. Your salary.
So right now that's joined together.
Yes.
But there is talk of...
Under the enabling legislation bills that have come out in the last couple of years, it is every faculty group and every individual campus would have the ability to form whatever collective bargaining unit they wanted. Every academic staff group would as well. Well, the faculty are not going to align with academic staff. That's a stretch. And when you look at collective bargaining on our campus, you can understand why the faculty wouldn't. They're less than half as large. So if everyone's got an equal vote in a collective bargaining unit, the academic staff would trounce faculty if there were ever an issue that split us, and salaries might split us. But if the Madison faculty were a unit, that's where the money would flow. And I don't see them ever combining with anyone else. Why would they? Why would they have to? They could control the bargaining and everyone else would be second. And I mean, in my hypothesis, it would be Madison faculty would be a separate unit. Then I think all the faculty in all the other units would, in fact, combine eventually. And all the academic staff would combine. But by the time you negotiated everything you were going to negotiate with the Madison faculty, then everything you were going to negotiate with the other faculty, academic staff's not going to have a whole lot to negotiate. And I think we would be told, well, you threw in the towel with governance then, and, you know, you decided to put your lot in with collective bargaining, so bargain everything. And, you know, you're not going to be involved in the committee structure anymore and blah, blah, blah. That has not panned out on other organized campuses, but I think it's an argument that's been used enough here that it might pan out here. So the only way enabling legislation is safe to pass would be if it says faculty and staff will negotiate, you know, and leave them as the group together that they are. But I don't see the young people coming up through the ranks being interested in this.
Myself included, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's probably a conversation to have.
Offline.
Because we're not... These interviews will and have talked about the present, but we're going to bring this back to the 75 through 85 period now. You mentioned Joe Elder as a faculty supporter, so who else besides Joe, if there are people, either on faculty or other aspects of campus who were supporters of academic staff?
Oh, not a whole lot of faculty. I have to say that Jim Donnelly in history was active in the union and really wanted a joint union, so he was pretty supportive. I'm running through my memories of administration and how unsupportive they were. There was not much support from the faculty. To be honest, Jim, maybe Bill Reznikoff. Because he was interested in seeing, you know, a joint union. Not much. Jack Ledinsky, another sociology guy, was pretty supportive. He was always wonderful on committee work. He never made a differentiation. So.
Okay. So as far as you can remember, the list is short.
Very.
And I know the answer to this, I think, but it never hurts to ask directly. And you mentioned earlier that students were for academic staff governance. In your opinion, why was it an easy sell for students?
Well, students, first of all, the TAA wanted to get their foot in the door, so you support us, we'll support you. And students, I think it was easy because they were delighted to be asked. You know, that even though they had governance, sometimes it's hard to get students to commit to committee work, and that's really where governance is done. And there were some years where, you know, student government did fun things like put flamingos on the hill or put a Statue of Liberty in the lake. So a lot of people did not take them seriously and were quite concerned. But their segregated fees were, you know, sponsored many wonderful programs. And I think they were impressed that we recognized that and said, we'd like your help with this. And we take you seriously. And we're delighted that you can take yourself seriously as well. So I really think it was mutual respect.
Might be a tough question to answer. Are there any names of the students that stand out?
No, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, it's...
I can remember all the sweatshop kids, but I can't...
What's faculty support? It might be close to wrapping up for now, for today. Trying to think if there's anything else that you've said. Well, while I'm thinking, is there anything else that you have said today, anything else that has sort of percolated to the front of your mind that we want to make sure we get on the tape this, on the recording this interview?
Not that I can think of.
Okay. Yeah, there's, I think there's going to be some other things once I do a little more searching in the documents that I'd like to ask specifically. And since I only have an hour today, I think it might be a good point to...
Well, actually, I will say something. One of the reasons that I was active is because I was totally allowed to be active. The director that hired me said, find a passion outside your office, because otherwise you'll go crazy if you just work, and run with it. And governance happened to be that. And he was absolutely remarkable. He was the director for only a couple of years. He's still a good friend, but he just said, it's okay. And when the TAA is picketing the building, you don't have to cross a picket line, you know, do whatever you can from home. You know, I know that this happens to be your area. I was never harassed for anything I did. I don't know how much protection that he offered me, or if it just didn't come up. Being young and being a woman actually was beneficial. I think people didn't necessarily take me seriously until we were well into a conversation, and that I was not scary, I was not threatening. And I was willing to talk to anybody, and made some sense. And then by the time a new director came on board, I had established this reputation both in the office and on campus as being kind of an activist, and he let me run with it too. There were other people who were told, you cannot leave the office during, you know, regular working hours. If you're going to meetings, you will take vacation time. People are being told that yet today. If you, if you take a long lunch because you're going to some session, you better clock that up and make sure that you account for every minute. That never happened to me. I was just treated very professionally and always had almost a pass. I can't account for it, except that I was lucky enough to have a very strong champion in the man who hired me. And again, I'm not real threatening.
I do have one more thing, right? And it's a very, well, maybe not an open-ended question, but how long did it take you to sort of wrap your mind around all the intricacies of this? Because we've talked about, you know, academic staff, ABC.
Oh, I never have. It's still out there. It still flummoxes me. And as a matter of fact, someone just got fired this week from UW System, and trying to ferret out the policies and procedures that would cover this young man. And, you know, it's not the Madison campus, it's UW System, so it's different, and because they wrote their own policies and procedures, and what's online, and where's your governance group, where's your academic staff, and trying to put that, I have never wrapped my mind around the intricacies, because they are very far-flung. And, you know, making sure that what I was saying to this young man was going to be pertinent to him, you know, it might have rolled off a little bit easier if it had been a UW-Madison person. But now we've got a different campus involved, and how does that work? And yet, I served for many years on the ASPRO board, which is the you know, lobbying group for academic staff that's system-wide. So I have friends across the whole system and have dealt with all their policies and procedures. But, oh my goodness, wrapping your head around it? not easy. Not easy.
All right. I hate to end it with not being able to wrap your mind around something.
but that's okay.
Unless you have anything again that sort of jumped out, let's stop for here, and we'll do one more sometime
soon.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Indeed.